Thank you, everyone, for coming out on a Thursday night and joining us for our campaign launch to get publicly owned and operated municipal broadband in Seattle, Washington. So, who are we? Upgrade Seattle. Basically, who we are is who you are. We're just regular citizens, a group of folks. Some of us were colleagues prior to coming together to mount this effort. I'm a media producer and an artist. Devin Glazer is a public policy student. Sabrina Roach is a she's a do-gooder. She does good things. She does good things, and you know, just from a point of disclosure, she is an employee with Brown Paper Tickets that has what they call a doer program, which basically allows her on Brown Paper Tickets' dime to do things like this from 9 to 5, 5 days a week. So without that resource, we probably would not have gotten this effort off the ground, and I think it's just kind of important to mention that. Karen Turing is a media activist, a social justice activist, a media producer, overall thought leader in our community. Hollis Wong Ware is a cultural activist, an artist, a spoken word poet, an all-around creative person. And there are a host of other folks that are involved in Upgrade Seattle that help us on the back end really make sure that we get this thing organized and that we build an infrastructure that is going to move this agenda forward. Let's move this along. So we're here. Why are we here? We're here because we believe that public broadband is basically a necessity. We believe that broadband in this day and age is akin to a utility. In fact, the president has gone ahead and made public statements to that effect, and the FCC is following suit, and there's lots of literature about that. I won't take a lot of time to talk about it. But the point is that we are looking at municipal broadband as an equity issue. Our broadband environment in Seattle is, to say the least, far less than equitable. Most of us are suffering with subpar internet service and greater than par internet prices. So you know, we really want to look at how can we make the service equitable across the city. How can we make the prices reasonable for everyone and make sure that all of us, from the north end of Seattle to the south end of Seattle, have fast, reliable, accessible, equitable broadband access. So how do we do it? Well, fortunately, we live in a city where our city government is looking at this seriously. They've been looking at it seriously for a long time. And probably the thing that will really help move this forward is if the public gets involved and says, you know, we're ready for this. It's time to make this happen. We've done enough studies. We've done enough public polls. We know people want it. We know it's possible. Other cities are doing it. We're a high-tech city. There's no reason why we should be lagging behind other cities and towns in this country. And so, you know, we as the people, you know, have the power and the responsibility to speak to our elected officials and let them know that it's time to solve this problem. And so that's what this campaign is all about. It's about galvanizing the public will and, you know, entering into, you know, a process with our public officials and letting them know it's time to come up with real solutions that work for all of us. And so as we move through the program tonight, it's important to think about everything that you hear and everything that you see in the framework of building a community-led movement to make this thing happen. Just to get started, where are we in Seattle with our broadband? Just a few basic facts. 93,000 Seattle residents currently live without internet access in the home. Okay, that's like none at all. So that essentially equates to 1 in 5 households. 1 of 2 households are in underserved communities that do not have access at home. And 2 out of 3 immigrant households lack internet access. And so, you know, we can have this conversation in our breakout groups. We can have this conversation as we move forward with the campaign. But as an equity issue, when we're talking about underserved communities and immigrant communities, that issue of equity and that issue of making a public investment that allows everyone in our community to contribute to our society will really help to underscore why this campaign is important. We have the next slide, please. Yeah, okay. So, 2/3 of Seattleites want the city to build an internet network, okay? And if I'm not mistaken, this is an infographic that came out of the city report. Is that correct? Yes. Okay, so this is an infographic that came out of the city of Seattle's recently published feasibility report on municipal broadband. They did a public poll. Just asking Seattle residents how they felt about their broadband service and what they felt about the possibility of a municipal broadband network. And the folks of the city spoke out overwhelmingly in favor of some sort of publicly facilitated broadband network. Next slide, please. Okay. All right, so the next one is the fiber map. Now, this is actually a really important piece. So this map is the city of Seattle. It's broken out into city council districts. So you can look to your neighborhood and see what your city council district is. But all those lines that you see, that is essentially a map of all of the existing dark fiber. That's the backbone for a high-speed internet network that is already installed in the city. We were fortunate as a city to have previous city managers that had the foresight to lay fiber down anytime there was a public works project and the city was the streets were opened up for other purposes. So as of today, we have a significant amount of the physical infrastructure to make this network possible. So when we're talking about public investment, we're not talking about starting from scratch. Okay, we're talking about starting with a fairly healthy head start. So what we're really looking at is what are the political dimensions of making this happen. Okay, and so as we think about it again, think about yourselves as important players in making that process move forward. Okay, so just some things to think about. We're here to, again, like I said, come up with solutions on how we as a community can make this vision a reality. In the process of doing so, you know, we will be engaging in, you know, a fairly involved political process. We'll be, you know, hopefully negotiating productively with the city of Seattle to make this happen. But, you know, we'll also be having to, you know, engage our partners in the private sector, which are, you know, the telecom companies. And, you know, it's really important for us to, you know, really stay on point and stay focused on what our goal is. You know, there are a lot of things that the private sector can do to detour the process, including short-term offers of, you know, bumping up speeds and lowering prices. You know, some of the telecom companies are doing some things that are kind of interesting now, but they're not doing it in a way that's truly equitable. So it's important not to allow the marketing language to derail, you know, what our larger agenda is. And, you know, aside from that, they spend a lot of money. They spend a lot of money in the community, not only with our politicians, but, you know, funding, you know, what would otherwise be, you know, laudable social investments with nonprofits. But the way that they leverage those investments is far from laudable. And so the next person I'm going to bring up is Julia Levy. She's from an organization called Real Girls. She's just going to share a story about an experience that they had with Comcast that really underscores some of the things that we have to be on point about being diligent about being aware of as we move through this process. So, Julie, if you'd come on up and share your story.
Hello. So I said, I'm Julie, and I'm from Real Girls. Real Girls is a nonprofit media training program for girls in the Seattle area. So we teach filmmaking and media literacy as a way to really empower young women in an industry that's heavily male-dominated and give them a way to tell their stories. I've been working with them for several years, and in 2011, I was an intern with Real Girls. And at the time, there was NBC, Universal, and Comcast were merging, and there had been, it was right after the merger, and during that time, FCC Commissioner Meredith Baker had been on that committee that approved the merger. She had actually, during the time, been kind of saying that the process was taking too long, and almost immediately after the merger had been approved, she left the FCC for a position with Comcast. And while that's legal, it definitely has something a little shady to it. And us, as an organization that's very rooted in media justice, we sent out a tweet about it. And we tweeted basically saying, like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. Like, hashtag media justice, that's weird. Shortly after, we received an email from Comcast saying that they were pulling $18,000 worth of funding from our summer programs that were scheduled to start in, I think, around June, and this was in May. So they overnight were like, they said that we had slammed them on social media, and that it was inappropriate, and that they didn't want to be funding an organization that was doing this to them, which was very surprising because the tweet was very, very tame, and very in line with our mission. So I came into the office and found out about this, and they asked me to make a video about it, which we're going to watch in a second. And so we decided to write the video kind of like a breakup letter to Comcast, and that's what we did. And it ended up being really successful for us. We ended up raising, I think, about $24,000 from individual donations all around the country, from abroad. Yeah. And it became like the summer of media justice for Real Girls. We, the program that they pulled funding from, normally we would make promotional videos for local nonprofits. And while we did some of that, we also had a group who focused mainly on making videos about media justice. And we also attended the AMC Media Conference in Detroit. And that was a really awesome way for a bunch of like people, we were, I think, like 14 to 18, to be able to go and meet with other people, other social justice leaders, and talk about media. So that's the story, and we can play the video.
I can't believe you broke up with me over email because of a tweet.
Come on, Comcast.
Hold on. We need to take this from the top. In January, FCC Commissioner Baker approved the billion-dollar merger between NBC, Universal, and Comcast.
Last week, she announced that she was leaving the FCC to go work for Comcast.
I was all OMG.
That's not right. So I tweeted about it.
Next thing I know, you email me to tell me you're cutting off the funding for my summer program at Real Girls.
What the heck, Comcast? I thought we were friends.
I thought you wanted me to speak my mind.
What will I do this summer if this program isn't funded?
So, there you go, Comcast. Our private sector community partners in broadband access. Nice. Okay, so our next person that we'll bring up, who I think will have some really interesting things to say about where the city stands on creating a municipal broadband network, is Michael Mattmiller. He's the chief, I'm going to make sure I get this right. He's the chief technology officer for the city of Seattle, and as he says, it allows him to do geeky stuff. So, not sure what that means. I'm sure he'll clarify that. Is he around here somewhere? Oh, there he is, right here. Okay.
All right, good evening. And thank you for coming out tonight, and thank you for having me. My name is Michael Mattmiller. I'm the city's chief technology officer and director of the Department of Information Technology. And while I know I've worked with Sabrina and Sarah and a number of others in this room, for those who don't know, the role of chief technology officer here in the city focuses on three things. It focuses on connecting people to their government. So our websites, our Seattle Channel cable television station, our open data platform, and other venues of communication between you and the city government. The second thing is ensuring a productive and efficient city workforce, so the infrastructure that delivers technology services throughout the city to our employees who are serving the public through the use of our services. And third, it's making Seattle a leader in digital equity across the nation. So things like our community technology program and technology matching funds, which will this year award almost $500,000 to community organizations working to solve the digital divide. It's our broadband strategy, which I'll talk more about here in a minute, as well as things like our privacy initiative that seeks to increase the amount of trust the public has when providing data to their government. So when I started last year, it was right around the same time that Mayor Murray outlined his vision for broadband here in the city of Seattle. And many of you have heard me say it before, that vision is that everyone in the city should have access to equal, affordable, and competitive broadband options. And not just broadband options, but options that approach the rapidly evolving gigabit standard. It's an ambitious goal and one that we've seen be challenged here in Seattle over the past few years. Mayor Murray also outlined three strategies of how we're going to achieve that goal. And those three strategies are, number one, reducing regulatory barriers; two, public-private partnerships; and three, if those first two strategies do not yield equal, affordable, and competitive gigabit broadband, understanding our ability to be a municipal broadband provider. So let's tick down where we are. Mayor Murray came out with that strategy roughly in May of last year. So at that time, very few, if any, single-family homes in the city of Seattle had access to gigabit broadband at home. We did see that some apartments and condos, through services like Condo Internet, had access to those kinds of speeds, but that was about it. So what we started working on was part of the first strategy, reducing regulatory barriers. We understood from companies here in our market that it was very hard to serve the city with broadband because it was impossible to go in and build new services. We changed something called the SDOT Director's Rule, and we had CenturyLink and Wave both step up and say that they would commit to building out broadband here in the city, and specifically fiber optic broadband with gigabit services. On public-private partnerships, we've been working with companies over the past several years to use some of that city-owned dark fiber that we saw on the map. And I don't know if it's possible. Could we show the broadband map again, since I know it's here? So this is the map. Yes, the city owns, as part of a consortium with 32 government agencies, about 550 miles of fiber optic cable running throughout the city. Now, one thing important to note is that it's not all dark fiber. In fact, most of it is used to connect to city buildings, meaning that it's not available as spare capacity. There's some limited portions of this that are spare capacity. So we've worked with a couple companies now. One company is providing broadband internet service to the International District using city-owned fiber, and we're working with another company that's interested in providing service in Belltown. So then we get to the third piece. If those first two strategies aren't succeeding, what is the city's ability to be a municipal broadband provider? And by now, we all know what the study said, and I know many folks in this room have drilled into the study, you've read the results, and I'll share what we've learned here in the city. One, we thought the cost to construct this network would come down, and it has. Since the last time we studied municipal broadband in 2011, the cost has come down about $200 million. But the unfortunate fact is that it still would cost somewhere between $480 and $660 million to construct this network. And unfortunately, while we were envisioning a ratepayer-funded model, so in other words, something like Chattanooga has done, where the people who buy the service fully pay for the service and it's a self-sustaining model. Unfortunately, the level of success we would have to attain in Seattle to be successful in that model is not feasible. We would have to be more successful than Chattanooga. We'd have to be more successful than most any city in this country has been at delivering municipal broadband. And if we failed, the general fund of government would be on the hook. That's the part of government that pays for police officers and firefighters and our Seattle.gov website and those services. And that's an unacceptable risk to the city. We just couldn't see a way that that ratepayer-funded model would be successful. I know the study also pointed out we could do a property tax, and we could. The risk on that side is if you look at the model and the data presented, we would still have to have a very high take rate to be successful, a take rate that exceeds 40%, granted at a lower price. But still, if we're unable to do that, if you know Comcast or CenturyLink or others were to meet our price or we weren't able to deliver, again, we would be at risk where we had this asset that people are paying for out of their property taxes for 20 years that's sitting unused. And that's still a pretty big risk and ask of our people here in Seattle. So I want to be the first to say that municipal broadband is not dead. We're still trying to figure out how we can make this work. It's just that one particular model, one model that's ratepayer funded, is something that we feel has an unacceptable level of risk. There could be other funding models out there, or other funding sources, excuse me, at the state or federal level. And so we are very interested, and we are currently investigating how it is that we could find new models or encourage the government to provide funding sources that could make this particular model something we could reconsider. So that's one thing that we're doing. There's also many other models out there for municipal broadband. When we look across the nation, just since President Obama mentioned municipal broadband in his State of the Union, we've seen some really creative solutions crop up. Solutions that in some cases involve a joint venture, where cities will build out a network and work with a partner to operate it in a way that helps mitigate the risk that the network will be able to cover its costs. So while we're looking at these, we are still very interested in digital equity here in Seattle, and I really love the focus that Upgrade Seattle is having on the equity issue. Today we know that 97% of Seattleites have access to broadband, and yet 15% of households don't take that service. And the question that we're still working through is why? You know, why is it that this is out there and people choose not to use it? Cost could be one of the issues. At the same time, though, we know that for many people in the city who have income limitations, our incumbent providers do provide low-income service at $9 per month. So why are people still not taking that? Is it the criteria? Is it that they don't see value in having internet at home? And those are issues we can overcome. One of the things that we're doing in the city is we've stood up the Digital Equity Action Committee as part of the Mayor's Digital Equity Initiative. We've convened a group of leaders from across communities, nonprofit organizations, corporations, and others to help think about where do we want to be as a society when it comes to internet access and digital literacy, and what are the strategies we need to employ to get there. And that group has been working for several months now to develop those things. We expect to have a final vision and goals by end of summer. But we know we're not there yet. We know we have to increase the number of people that have access to the internet. They need to know what to do when they get online. And I very much look forward to keeping the dialogue going and understanding the thoughts that you come up with tonight and in the future. So please feel free to reach out if you have questions about the study or our thinking in the city. And thank you for your continued interest in this issue.
So where is your place?
All right. Okay. So we're going to get into the heart of our event tonight. We've got what we expect to be an extremely interesting conversation between Christopher Mitchell and Hollis Wong Ware. I've heard Christopher speak on a number of occasions, and every time he speaks, I learn many, 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 many new things. So I'm really looking forward to having a very open-ended conversation with him. There will be a 15-minute Q&A. Following the conversation. So as they're speaking, please, please, please think about something that you would like to ask. Make a little note, and you can come up to the mic, queue up, and ask your question. So who is Christopher Mitchell? Christopher Mitchell is the director of the Community Broadband Networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the policy director for Next Century Cities. His work focuses on how communities can improve their internet access. Hollis Wong Ware is a writer, performer, and creative producer. She is the lead vocalist and acting manager of the Seattle-based electronic R&B band, The Flavor Blue, and was nominated for a Grammy for her work with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis for their album, The Heist. She is a spoken word poet and an alum and a fierce advocate of You Speak Seattle. She graduated from Seattle University and currently serves on the Seattle Center Advisory Commission and the Seattle Music Commission and the Board of Directors for 4 Culture. So would you please give a warm welcome to Christopher Mitchell and Hollis Wong Ware.
Hey, everyone. How's everybody doing today?
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. I'm thrilled to be a part of Upgrade Seattle. I'm thrilled to have for us to be hosting Chris today. He has kind of been making the rounds on local media as well as lunches. So this is one of a series of events that we've had you for, but your expertise and you as a national resource is fantastic to have in this conversation today and in the launch of this campaign. I don't profess to be an industry expert or an internet expert by any means, but I am an enthusiast, and by an enthusiast I mean I'm a user of the internet. Put your hand up if you use the internet today. All right, great. So I'm really glad that we're all here today to have this conversation. As an artist, digital resources and internet access is at the core of everything that I do as a professional, whether that's from music creation all the way to the distribution, to the networking, the sharing, and the connections that I can make. And today, in particular, you know, when in processing the horrible atrocity that happened in Charleston, I just was further reminded that internet access has really become a central place of convening and of processing, of learning, of education, of true emotive process and explanation. When it comes to issues such as, if you can just see the way that the social movement of Black Lives Matter has developed, internet was at the crux of how that became a household conversation. And so I think about how internet is really at the core of social movements at this point in time. And as somebody who's interested in fighting for equity and social justice within our society, I am further inspired to be involved in this movement to think about digital equity, particularly in our city that is becoming so deeply defined by our technology advancements and our innovation. How do we ensure that that development and that advancement is equitably shared amongst all the citizens that live here and not just for the few? So with all of that, I'm really excited to have this conversation and to hear from you and then to have this work group happening so we can think about how we can make this a reality. Because I will say, I think that internet will inevitably be a public utility, and I think that we are uniquely poised to make that a reality and be a national leader like we have in the past. So, Chris, I'm curious to start off kind of with a recent win in the fight towards an open internet and accessible internet across the nation. I'm curious if you could talk more about your personal work and the collective work that was done in the fight and the win for net neutrality.
Absolutely. And let me start by just thanking everyone for coming out, thanking Upgrade Seattle for hosting. There's so much good work that's going on here. I'm just thrilled to be able to come out and share what's happening around the country. And one of those things is this fight for net neutrality, the open internet, and that sort of thing. And it was really stunning when we realized we were actually going to implement really good, enforceable, open rules to basically make sure that there would not be a gatekeeper that was sort of getting between us and the internet. And I just remember back years ago when people would basically say, there's just no way. We're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. You're not going to be able to get to overcome the lobbyist power in D.C. And we had, over the last year, some 4 million comments were filed in D.C. There was all kinds of people that organized groups. There was people that specifically focused on historically marginalized populations to make sure that their voices were heard. And it just really changed the conversations in ways that people didn't predict. They said it about the Comcast merger. They said that it would be that this country doesn't really stop those kind of mergers anymore. And really dedicated people did. And I would say the same thing with I just remember first hearing about the $15 an hour minimum wage, and I said, yeah, I think I'll probably see that in my lifetime, but certainly not anytime soon. And so we have this sense right now that when people are organized, we can really do important things.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that definitely it's wonderful to be in Seattle, but also to look across nationally and see that the momentum is really building in terms of citizen-led movements and the achievements that they can attain, even though lots of naysayers and companies may seem like roadblocks for that. So I'm curious, as we're focusing on Seattle and all of us being of the Seattle area and looking forward to how we can really think about strategies and tactics for how we can all come together towards municipal broadband, I'm curious where you see Seattle fitting into the national conversation, where we're placed and how we might be positioned strategically as we start this dialogue.
One of the things that I like to say that sometimes surprises people is that Comcast towns can actually be quite fortunate. If you're stuck with a national cable monopoly, Comcast is kind of the one to be with. It's much better than Time Warner Cable. And I know it's much better than many of the alternatives, frankly, in terms of the kind of... You know that Seattle's not going to be the last place in the country to get something, and that's good. Seattle's, at the worst, Seattle's going to be the middle of the road. And I think we could say that for CenturyLink in some ways as well. CenturyLink has invested more in fiber to the home in Seattle than most places. However, it's really priced at an unreasonable amount for most households. So if you make, you know, if you're willing to spend more than $100 a month for high-quality internet access, and I'm happy to give my address to any CenturyLink representatives here as to where I live in St. Paul to do that, then you're set, though. But if you're willing to spend a lot, you're set. But if you're not, then Seattle's in a similar place as most other large cities, which is to say that people who don't have a lot of money to spend on internet access, they're really being left behind. And in that regard, I think Seattle's very similar to most of the rest of the country.
Word. I think that like one thing that I think about as well in terms of really marrying this with equitable access is just how many resources at this point are either only accessible via internet or are largely accessible via internet. And oftentimes those are social services and educational opportunities and resources that will most impact low income or marginalized populations. Yet, as we saw the statistic, there's tens of thousands of people within Seattle, and particularly in low income and particularly immigrant populations, that simply don't have access to these tools. And you know, and I dream of a world where imagine how fantastic the educational opportunities could be within our public school system if it was ascertained and made sure that every single student could go home and have internet access available at their home. Like how much that would transform the opportunities that are available for children up into obviously working professionals and any generation that lives in our city. And so for our planning today, Chris, as you'll kind of be, I believe, floating about as we talk via districts or via areas about our neighborhood strategies and our area strategies towards fighting for municipal broadband, I'm curious, what is an initial timeline that you envision that we should be aiming for or that we should frame our community engagement towards? And maybe if you were even to set a milestone, like in a year from now, exactly a year from this conversation that we're all together, what's something that we should really be aiming to attain to make sure that we're really pushing the dial forward to making sure that Seattle is not only developing tech companies, but also developing tech equity and tech access to our city and becoming a national leader?
Right. Well, I definitely think this is an area where Seattle has the resources and the will. I think there's a lot of stars that are aligning for Seattle to be a real leader in terms of how to make sure that everyone's connected. And I don't mean, let me just say briefly that the whole $10 a month plan, I have a colleague who is a single mother, qualifies for that, and she went through it. She has telecommunications background, and she explained how she explained to the Comcast representatives on the phone what the program was and how they had to figure out how to get her signed up for it. It was a brutal process, and it took like 3 months. A lot of low-income families are moving, not that much more frequently than the time it takes to set it up. On top of that, you get a device that allows you to attach one device per household to it at a time. So if you got two kids, they get to fight over who's doing their internet and who's doing their homework at any given time. This is not a way to solve our problem. And frankly, Comcast didn't have to do that. They did, and that's a credit to them. But shame on us for not coming up with a better way of making sure that all kids have access in the home. But I think in the next year, the thought would be to identify where there are resources, to identify a pilot project. Or not really, I mean, a pilot project is sort of the wrong term because we know what the technology can do. We have a sense of what the goals are, though. That needs to be fleshed out, a real sense of what are the goals of the first phase of a longer project. But identifying where in the city would be a good place to start with some kind of solution that looks at how to make sure everyone has a basic connection at home. And there's different ways of looking at funding it and how how you might connect the more affluent households, or whether you just leave that to the private markets. There's a number of things that could be worked out. But the first thing, I think, is to do that, to say we are going to identify an area. The report from last week identifies three different candidates with some intelligent thinking about it, but that's something that should be examined.
What, do you mind expounding on what those three areas were?
Well, it's three neighborhoods. One of them's Beacon Hill. Beacon Hill, I believe.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, there, no. My knowledge of the same.
Thank you. Beacon Hill, Central District, Queen Anne.
So they have these three areas. They identified a way you could start a $5 million budget to cover those three areas. Now, there's, I think, a variety of things that could go into that to make sure that people have the connectivity at home. I think some families may require no cost. Some might be able to afford $10 for a real connection. But that's one thing, I think, which is identifying those goals. The other thing is what the city's already doing should be encouraged to continue doing it, and I think, you know, pushed along as rapidly as it can, which is to continue getting more fiber in the ground at low cost as part of other projects. This is something that Seattle's been a leader on among large cities, and something that, frankly, with all the transportation planning right now, there's some real opportunities to make sure that there's going to be a fiber and conduit in the ground. And I think that over time, there will be more opportunities to do more of that, because the public's demand for better connections will be growing in that time.
I was just curious if you had any commentary on what Michael Mattmiller actually just presented in terms of the city's official stance, the city's analysis of the study that was done. He cited Chattanooga as an example, but I'm curious if there's any alternative forms that we should be looking at as potential kind of markers towards our independent strategy towards municipal broadband.
Yes, and this is where I try to avoid spending an hour going into a bunch of different things that we're seeing experimented with. I echo his comments. I'm a rather conservative person by nature, more conservative than most people imagine, as I sort of am part of this big fight against these established companies. The risk is great for the city to move forward, but I actually would say that the city is smart not to go forward with that citywide plan, because if the city was to do that, the focus would be on figuring out how to make it cash flow. It would be focused on the people who can afford $75 a month. And frankly, I think those people, like myself, I'm one of those people, would love to have that option. But the focus really should be on the people that are not connected, the people that have been left behind. So I think it's smart for the city to be thinking, how can we re-engage on an incremental basis with an acceptable level of risk, and a phased approach that would allow us to say, you know what, phase one and two are going great, but we're going to wait for phase three because we're anticipating a downturn, or, you know, just being able to adjust it on the fly. Let me say that's something you have to put a lot of faith in your elected leaders, that they're going to continue it. So you have to be engaged in the process throughout the way to make sure that a different mayor or a different city council doesn't decide to just change priorities. So this is Upgrade Seattle is a very good step in that direction.
Excellent. I think and I obviously wouldn't want to impose my personal beliefs upon all of you, but if you're anything like me and you believe that digital access truly is a civil rights issue, that the notion of more digital tools and digital opportunities and digital resources being accessible to all citizens in Seattle is important. To me, what was helpful to frame this conversation was really switching the paradigm between thinking of people who use the internet as customers and more as citizens. For customers, you can choose who your market is. You can say, oh, well, I want to make this accessible to these people, but those don't have to be in my market. But to most of us, digital access is fundamentally necessary for us and our livelihoods. Thinking about what our responsibility is as citizens to make sure that every single citizen has equitable, fast, affordable access to the internet is really kind of what drives me personally to be part of this, and why I'm really excited to see all of you here so we can start strategizing on it. So Chris, thank you so much for your initial insight, and I'm excited to open it up to questions. I will say again that everyone is invited to come up and ask a question of Chris, and as somebody who does this work nationally, I think it's important to note that you go to all sorts of towns, big or small, to check out what they're doing in way of municipal broadband. I'll also say that we are asking everybody to ask a question. That commentary can be left for the breakout sessions that we do. And if you decide to start commenting, I will have the authority to cut you off. All right, let's start.
We have two microphones, apparently. This is a surprise to
sure.
me.
We'll go over here, and then we'll come back to you. Thank you.
I had a question. There are some communities who have used open wireless access points in their, you know, in their downtown area, and they've also experimented with moving it out from the downtown to other neighborhoods. Could you give us an idea just what your thoughts about that as a kind of an interim thing that the city might consider doing, or what the experience has been in other communities when they've done that?
So wireless, traditionally, it's been difficult to deploy them in outdoor settings to provide wide coverage and actually have it penetrate buildings. So if you want to give people high-quality access indoors, it's proven thus far to be a real challenge. It's very expensive to do that. However, it's a good stepping stone, particularly in populations that are heavily reliant on mobile devices that already use it. These are populations for whom the data plans can be, the cost of using a lot of data is can be very expensive. And so when they're relying on that, the ability to have free Wi-Fi is tremendous, or some sort of predictable, low-cost, unlimited Wi-Fi option. It's something that sometimes is called FiWi for fiber wireless as opposed to Wi-Fi, which is basically it takes a long time to get fiber out to everyone if that's your plan. But you get fiber to the key areas along the backbone, and you spend it a little bit, and then you start providing a high-quality wireless signal while you're then starting to get the fiber the rest of the way. So it's an incremental approach that makes sense.
That's interesting. So that could actually kind of be a complementary push if you're thinking about, okay, we want to just grow the dark fiber access incrementally. However, we could also think about these key points where we could provide a high access, really fast, really reliable internet that's better than just your regular run-of-the-mill Wi-Fi. That's interesting.
The reason we don't see it a whole lot is Wi-Fi has a high operating cost and generates very little revenue. So there's a tremendous challenge of the technology could do it, but there's a real economics challenge of going with that approach.
I think just because you brought it up, just really quickly, it's also important to think of it in terms of digital access and equity, how we're using the internet. So many people, especially in lower income regions or communities, mobile access is oftentimes the only kind of implement to used for digital access and internet access. So thinking about how much data costs to utilize that, and so how we can level the playing field for those where a mobile device is really the only way to access the web. So, great. Go ahead.
I'm a high school teacher, and it's essential that the students have access to the internet and their families. My question is, it seemed like a stumbling block to the Seattle report last week was the hundreds of millions of dollars that might be at risk, and that was the impediment. We don't require other city services, like the libraries, the fire department, police department, to be self-supporting. Why is there an assumption that this service needs to be self-supporting before it can be implemented? Why not consider it like other city services?
That's a very good question. You know, one answer that I'll give, and there's a lot of answers that go down this path, is that other city services don't have lobbyists from powerful companies in City Hall, in the State House, and in the federal government. It's a different dynamic, but we're very fast, in a very fast way, moving in that direction. And the number of, I've seen it more often in Republican rural communities where they're basically jettisoning the old idea, and they're saying, we're going to use a part of our budget to build high-quality internet infrastructure that will be available to multiple companies or various approaches. So we're hitting the tipping point for people. Like, the people in the audience are pretty well representative of a lot of thought of this. Elected officials, we haven't hit that tipping point yet. They're trailing behind us, and we need to move them up a little bit.
Cool. Thank you for doing this presentation. There's something that I think that the city could do today or almost immediately, which is to turn on public access through the wireless mesh net, which is fiber-backed, that we already have installed throughout the downtown, which, you know, these reports talk about how many households have access to the internet. There are a great many people in the city who don't have a home. Maybe they need a job. Maybe they need to get access to these services that are only available online. And we have these devices on the poles. We could turn on public access. The police and the emergency services aren't even using them because they've been unable to come up with a privacy policy. Why don't we do that? I don't understand.
That is a good question that I cannot answer, unfortunately. But I think it's good to raise it in a public forum. And I
can actually answer that.
In the event anyone didn't hear that, the answer is the city is working on that.
But is worth bringing up in our small group conversation and then reporting back.
Hello, I'm Mitchell Shook, the founder and CEO of Advanced Stream. Made the drive up from Tacoma. We operate on the Click Network, on an open access network. We've been fortunate to have that for the past 18 years. And we've had the mayors down from Seattle over the years to review what we've done in Tacoma. You're familiar with our Click Network. So have you considered open access? And have you heard about the National Broadband Plan?
Yes, and I think I've been an advisor of sorts to Upgrade Seattle, and I think the focus of Upgrade Seattle has been on a municipally owned, municipally operated network. But I think that there are a lot of benefits to open access, and I think the question will be, as we move forward, how it will look. And so I don't think anyone's foreclosed the possibility, but the focus is really making sure, as I understand it, that everyone's going to have a high-quality access and whatever it takes to get there. I just want to make it very clear. Chattanooga gets sort of is attacked sometimes in some ways for getting this money. They started building their network before the economy collapsed, before the stimulus package was ever envisioned. They then got money from the Department of Energy to expedite it and to build the most advanced electrical grid that is basically known to humankind. And a lot of that money didn't really help their fiber distribution. It was for these very sort of high-tech gizmos that make sure that when tornadoes destroy their lines, that very few houses go down. There's a lot of other municipal networks that have built it without a dime of subsidy. Lafayette, Louisiana, Wilson, North Carolina. So it's important to note that while I think Seattle is smart to look for various sources of funding, specifically to make sure that it's building these networks in a new way, to make sure that everyone's connected, and there's a real focus on equity, that it's not that Seattle sort of missed out somehow or it's being treated unfairly because others have, in some cases, gotten subsidies.
Great. Thank you.
Hi. I think you just recently touched on that. I was curious how the Seattle situation and the Chattanooga situation compare and contrast. One of the main concerns seemed to be that if Seattle moved forward with this, that the ISPs would lower their prices and it wouldn't be competitive and the economics wouldn't work out for the city. So how did the ISPs react in Chattanooga's situation, for example, and how did the city mitigate that risk?
Well, Chattanooga will say that Comcast, for the first time in the history of the network, prioritized Chattanooga for upgrades over Atlanta. That's something they hadn't seen before. Chattanooga, first of all, one of the things that Comcast did before the network was built was run 2,600 advertisements saying, "This is going to be awful. You guys are going to be so upset that you built this network. It's going to be a disaster." Not exactly prescient Nostradamus-type predictions there. So they tried to scare them out of it, and then they lowered their prices. They then increased their prices back up, and now they've lowered them again. So it's kind of hard to figure out what's happening. But the thing is that they lower the prices individually. It's not that everyone gets a discount. It's that promos last longer, and if you're willing to haggle on the phone, you can get better prices. So it is better for the community, but it can be hard to measure exactly how much. I think you could estimate that it's over $10 million of more money that's in the local economy because of the savings from lower rates. And that's also true of Tacoma, where the vast competition enabled by the city network that also has all these different providers that are operating on it, that's led to tremendous savings across Tacoma, where people have more money in their pockets at the end of the month, which is a big deal.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, I actually had two questions. I was wondering if you could clarify a little bit about the difference between the spare fiber and the dark fiber. And I had been surfing some of the information on the Seattle.gov website. They have an open data library with regard to the income and the zoning considerations, and I pulled some data out of that API, and I found out that there are tremendous differences in like the way that the income levels between like the different regions. So I was wondering if you would balance that out. Like if internet became a city utility, would it be more like by income, or would it be like by region, or how would that be different from the way it is now with the regular service?
Right. Well, I think one thing that I would the first question is actually really easy, the technical question, which is the difference between the dark fiber and the lit fiber. And that's when the city was putting in fiber for its needs, in many cases it would put in more fiber than it needed because the cost of doing that is very low, especially when compared to the benefit of having extra fiber. Now, over time, some of that fiber gets used up, sometimes by the city, or sometimes they've leased it out. So at a certain point, you can run out of fiber in certain segments of the network, and that's what's happened. So there's areas that have more capacity than others for doing different things. The other part of the question, I think, we're in an unfortunate reality where I think that Seattle might very well have to say, all right, Comcast, CenturyLink, Wave, perhaps others that are going to be coming in the near future, you can have the areas where people are able to pay for the network, and we're going to focus on the areas where people struggle a little bit more. That is the direction that we're going in the United States in telecommunications policy, in the sense that we're seeing some people cherry picking, cream skimming, pick your metaphor, it all involves food, it seems like. But the idea is basically that where there's profit to be made, you make profit. And it used to be that you take that profit and you'd subsidize the cost of serving people that had a greater need or a higher cost. And we've moved away from that. The idea was we'd have great competition and that would result in all this, we'd solve all these problems because we'd drive the prices low. But it turns out that when you have a few industries that have a ton of lobbying power in D.C., competition is harder to come by than it was anticipated in 1996. So we basically screwed up universal service, and I think we're looking at an expensive solution to make sure that people have access. But cities that take action earlier are going to pay less, because the longer you wait, the more cherry-picking and cream-skimming will go on, and so the sooner you act to make sure that you're able to, if you connect a neighborhood that has a lot of low-income folks, you're also going to have some businesses in that area that might take service. But if you wait, someone else is going to connect those businesses and not the people. So you want to make sure you act before you get too far down that line. So that's a very good challenge. I think that's very smart, because there's a danger, to recap the question, that that then the service in those low-income areas would be deprioritized. And I think that's a definite potential problem. I think the challenge is, if you're looking at an incremental approach, if you're going to start by also serving some of the areas of higher need, then you have, economically, that makes a lot of sense. But then you have a question of why do some people have a choice in gigabit service while other people don't have a single option that's affordable? So these are political questions that I think need to be wrestled with. And I think one of the things that we want to make sure doesn't happen is that people are left with a substandard option. I think you're right. There's no easy answer to that. And I'm glad you challenged me with that, frankly, because people need to remain engaged. And that's ultimately what we come down to.
All right. We're going to have one more question. Thank you for that follow-up. And then we are going to break out into small groups. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm kind of a contrarian, so I'm going to challenge some things that I've heard here tonight. I've been on this fight since the mid-1990s, since before some of the people here were born. And this is a fight that many of us have been fighting, not with Comcast, not with CenturyLink, but with the city. I think it's important to understand where the problem lies. The fastest internet in this city right now is on my phone. Okay? I happen to have CenturyLink DSL. Frequently less than 1 megabit to my house. Never more than four, even though I'm paying for six. Okay? Comcast, slightly faster, also goes out during the rush hour. We heard a speaker here tonight talk about how important it is for students to have access to internet. I'm required by my employer to have access, high-speed access to my home. So this is not a toy. It's not something that we can just shrug off and not use. It is a critical city service. But I want to challenge the idea of pitting one neighborhood against another. What's made these fights successful in cities around the country is when everyone comes together. Our vision for a network here in Seattle has always been that one neighborhood would talk to another on the same network, that we would be able to envision and implement applications and usages that would unite the city and tie it together, not just through a network, but economically, politically, socially, culturally. We can't do that if our networks are balkanized, our neighborhoods are balkanized, and we have haves and have-nots.
No, Michael, I agree with you. I think that's very smart. And I think that if I had to put words in Matt Miller's mouth right now, which I'm willing to do because he's got a really nice smile. He seems very friendly. I think he would say, I would love to see a lot of people demanding that City Hall do this, that there's a growth of support to do this. I think Mayor Murray is smart in saying that I don't want to necessarily do a massive investment to try and do this when I know the marketing power that's going to go into trying to poison citizens against this. And so I would say that the goal then is to get as many people in Seattle enthusiastic about this as possible to make it a top issue. So it's not a person's sixth or seventh issue, but it's one of their top issues. Because we can talk about what our elected leaders should do and what we think they should do, but we need to make them do things. That's the way it works here, really. I mean, the Republic is not about sort of electing the smartest people. It's electing people who are then going to be forced to do things by movements, I think, in many ways. Maybe that's not the way it was envisioned, but that certainly seems to be the way it's working out. And so one of the benefits, I think, of starting incrementally is that when you have people that say, this incremental approach means I'm going to get it in my neighborhood in 24 years, I'm going to call my city council member and say, you got to make this a bigger priority. So I would say that in the beginning, you may see it as pitting neighborhood against neighborhood, but I see it as a potential organizing strategy to get the political will that is necessary for elected leaders to take on some of the most powerful companies that exist in the country right now.
Great. I think that's thank you so much for your question, and I think that's a really great place for us to delve into our conversations and really tease out these dense and complex issues. Can we just give a round of applause really quickly for Chris for sharing his insight?